Mentors. In 1922, Eisenhower was ordered to Panama, where he joined the 20th Infantry Brigade. 2 years in Panama did two things for Ike. First, it allowed him a change of scene after the death of his firstborn son, Ikey. Second, it introduced him to General Fox Connor. As the historian Gene Edward Smith put it, Fox Connor was understatement personified, self-possessed, soft-spoken, eminently formal, and polite. A general who loved reading, a profound student of history, and a keen judge of military talent. Connor was completely devoid of theatricality. From Connor, Ike learned the maxim, always take your job seriously, never yourself. Fox Connor served as the beau ideal of the humble leader. A sense of humility is a quality I have observed in every leader whom I have deeply admired, Eisenhower later wrote. My own conviction is that every leader should have enough humility to accept, publicly, the responsibility for the mistakes of the subordinates he has himself selected, and likewise, to give them credit, publicly, for their triumphs. Connor, Ike continued, was a practical officer, down to earth, equally at home in the company of the most important people in the region and with any of the men in the regiment. He never put on airs of any kind, and he was as open and honest as any man I have ever known. He has held a place in my affections for many years that no other, not even a relative, could obtain. Connor also revived Ike's love of the classics, military strategy, and world affairs. Eisenhower called his service under Connor a sort of graduate school in military affairs and the humanities, leavened by the comments and discourses of a man who was experienced in his knowledge of men and their conduct. It was the most interesting and constructive period of my life. On a visit to Panama, Ike's boyhood friend Edward Swede Hazlitt noted that Eisenhower had fitted up the second-story screened porch of their quarters as a rough study, and here, with drawing board and texts, he put in his spare time refighting the campaigns of the old masters. At the same time, Ike was particularly affected by the training of a horse, Blackie. In his memoirs, he wrote, "In my experience with Blackie, and earlier with allegedly incompetent recruits at Camp Colt, is rooted my enduring conviction that far too often we write off a backward child as hopeless, a clumsy animal as worthless, a worn-out field as beyond restoration. This we do largely out of our own lack of willingness to take the time and spend the effort to prove ourselves wrong, to prove that a difficult boy can become a fine man, that an animal can respond to training, that the field can regain its fertility." General Connor arranged for Eisenhower to attend the Command and General Staff School at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. He would graduate first in his class of 245 officers. Like Blackie, he was not to be written off. In 1933, after graduating from the War College as one of the youngest officers ever to attend, Eisenhower was appointed General Douglas MacArthur's personal assistant. For the next several years, Eisenhower worked with MacArthur, primarily in the Philippines, helping that nation prepare for its independence. Douglas MacArthur was the theatrical one. Ike respected MacArthur, but was put off by his grandiosity. He described MacArthur as an aristocrat, but as for me, I'm just folks. Under MacArthur, Eisenhower met the ultimate test of his temper. Their small office rooms adjoined, separated by only a slatted door. "He called me to his office by raising his voice," Eisenhower remembered. "He was decisive, personable, and he had one habit that never ceased to startle me. In reminiscing or in telling stories, he talked of himself in the third person." Several times Ike asked to leave his staff assignment. MacArthur denied the request, insisting Eisenhower's work in the Philippines was far more important than anything he could do as a mere lieutenant colonel in the American Army. Ike was disappointed, but he remained with MacArthur for 6 more years, working behind the scenes with more and more planning work falling on his shoulders. Ike remained respectful in his boss's presence, but eventually came to detest MacArthur for the way he put himself above the institution. After one of MacArthur's more memorable acts of egomania, Eisenhower erupted in the privacy of his diary. "But I must say, it is almost incomprehensible that after 8 years of working for him, writing every word he publishes, keeping his secrets, preventing him from making too much of an ass of himself, trying to advance his interests while keeping myself in the background, he should suddenly turn on me. He'd like to occupy a throne room surrounded by experts in flattery, while in a dungeon beneath, unknown to the world, would be a bunch of slaves doing his work and producing the things that, to the public, would represent the brilliant accomplishment of his mind. He's a fool, but worse, he is a puking baby." Eisenhower served loyally and humbly, putting himself inside the mind of his superior, adopting his perspectives as his own, getting his work done efficiently and on time. In the end, the officers he served, MacArthur included, ended up promoting him. And when the great challenge of his life came during World War II, Ike's ability to repress his own passions served him well. He never greeted war with a sense of romantic excitement, the way his lifelong colleague George S. Patton did. He saw it as another hard duty to be endured. He had learned to focus less on the glamour and excitement of wartime heroics and more on the dull, mundane things that would prove to be the keys to victory. Preserving alliances with people you might find insufferable. Building enough landing craft to make amphibious invasions possible. Logistics. Eisenhower was a masterful wartime commander. He suppressed his own frustrations in order to keep the international alliance together. He ferociously restrained national prejudices, which he felt as acutely as anyone, in order to keep the disparate armies on the same team. He passed credit for victories on to his subordinates and, in one of the most famous unsent messages in world history, was willing to put the blame for failures upon himself. This was the memo he was going to release if the D-Day invasion failed. "Our landings have failed, and I have withdrawn the troops," he wrote. "My decision to attack at this time and place was based upon the best information available. The troops, the air, and the Navy did all that bravery and devotion could do. If any blame or fault attaches to the attempt, it is mine alone." Eisenhower's disciplined and self-regulating life had its downsides. He was not a visionary. He was not a creative thinker. In war, he was not a great strategist. As president, he was often oblivious to the most consequential emerging historical currents of his time, from the civil rights movement to the menace of McCarthyism. He was never good with abstract ideas. He behaved disgracefully in failing to defend General George C. Marshall from attacks upon his patriotism, to his great regret and shame later on. And all that artificial self-restraint could make him cold when he should have been warm, ruthlessly practical when he should have been chivalrous and romantic. His behavior toward his mistress, Kay Summersby, at the end of the war is repellent. Summersby had served and presumably loved Eisenhower through the hardest years of his life. He did not give her even the benefit of a goodbye. One day she found that her name had been dropped from his travel roster. She received an icy typewritten note from Ike on official army stationery. "I am sure you understand that I am personally much distressed that an association that has been so valuable to me has to be terminated in this particular fashion, but it is by reasons over which I have no control. I hope that you will drop me a note from time to time. I will always be interested in how you are getting along." He had become so practiced at suppressing his own emotions that in this moment he was even able to suppress any hint of compassion, any ember of gratitude. Eisenhower was occasionally aware of his shortcomings. Thinking of his hero, George Washington, he said, "I've often felt the deep wish that the good Lord had endowed me with his clarity of vision in big things, his strength of purpose, and his genuine greatness of mind and spirit." But for some, life is the perfect school. It teaches them exactly those lessons they will need later on. Eisenhower was never a flashy man, but two outstanding traits defined the mature Eisenhower, traits that flowed from his upbringing and that he cultivated over time. The first was his creation of a second self. Today we tend to live within an ethos of authenticity. We tend to believe that the true self is whatever is most natural and untutored. That is, each of us has a certain sincere way of being in the world, and we should live our life being truthful to that authentic inner self, not succumbing to the pressures outside ourself. To live artificially with a gap between your inner nature and your outer conduct is to be deceptive, cunning, and false. Eisenhower hewed to a different philosophy. This code held that artifice is man's nature. We start out with raw material, some good, some bad, and this nature has to be pruned, girdled, formed, repressed, molded, and often restrained, rather than paraded in public. A personality is a product of cultivation. The true self is what you have built from your nature, not just what your nature started out with. Eisenhower was not a sincere person. He hid his private thoughts. He recorded them in his diary, and they could be scathing. Of Senator William Noland, he wrote, "In his case, there seems to be no final answer to the question, how stupid can you get?" But in public, he wore a costume of affability, optimism, and farm boy charm. As president, he was perfectly willing to appear stupider than he really was, if it would help him perform his assigned role. He was willing to appear tongue-tied if it would help him conceal his true designs. Just as he learned to suppress his anger as a boy, he learned to suppress his ambitions and abilities as an adult. He was reasonably learned in ancient history, admiring especially the crafty Athenian leader Themistocles, but he never let that on. He did not want to appear smarter than other people, or somehow superior to the average American. Instead, he cultivated the image of simple, unlearned charm. As president, he would supervise a detailed meeting about an arcane topic, issuing clear and specific instructions about what was to be done. Then he would go out to a press conference and massacre the English language in an effort to disguise his designs. Or he would just pretend the whole subject was over his head. "That's just too complicated for a dumb bunny like me." He was willing to appear more stupid than he really was. This is how we know he was not a New Yorker. Ike's simplicity was strategic. After his death, his vice president Richard Nixon recollected, "Ike was a far more complex and devious man than most people realized, and in the best sense of these words, not shackled to a one-track mind. He always applied two, three, or four lines of reasoning to a single problem. His mind was quick and facile. He was a famously good poker player." Ike's wide smile, open as the Kansas sky, Evan Thomas writes, concealed a deep secretiveness. He was honorable but occasionally opaque, outwardly amiable but inwardly seething. Once before a press conference, his press secretary, Jim Haggerty, informed him of an increasingly delicate situation in the Formosa Strait. Ike smiled and said, "Don't worry, Jim. If that question comes up, I'll just confuse them." Predictably, the question was raised by journalist Joseph Harsh. Good-naturedly, Eisenhower responded, "The only thing I know about war is two things. The most changeable factor in war is human nature in its day-by-day manifestation. But the only unchanging factor about war is human nature. And the next thing is that every war is going to astonish you in the way it occurred and the way it is carried out. So I think you just have to wait. And that is the kind of prayerful decision that may someday face a president." After the conference, Thomas writes, Eisenhower himself joked that he must have given fits to Russian and Chinese translators trying to explain to their bosses what he meant. Ike's double nature could make it hard for people to really know him. "I don't envy you trying to figure Dad out," John Eisenhower told the biographer Evan Thomas. "I can't figure him out. After his death, his widow Mamie was asked whether she had really known her husband. "I'm not sure anyone did," she replied. But self-repression helped Eisenhower to control his natural desires and to fulfill the tasks assigned to him, both by his military superiors and by history. He looked simple and straightforward, but his simplicity was a work of art. Moderation. His final trait, which ripened with his full maturity, was moderation. Moderation is a generally misunderstood virtue. It is important to start by saying what it is not. Moderation is not just finding the midpoint between two opposing poles and opportunistically planting yourself there. Neither is moderation bland equanimity. It's not just having a temperate disposition that doesn't contain rival passions or competing ideas. On the contrary, moderation is based on an awareness of the inevitability of conflict. If you think that the world can fit neatly together, then you don't need to be moderate. If you think all your personal qualities can be brought together into simple harmony, you don't need to hold back. You can just go whole hog for self-actualization and growth. If you think all moral values point in the same direction or all political goals can be realized all at once by a straightforward march along one course, you don't need to be moderate either. You can just head in the direction of truth as quickly as possible. Moderation is based on the idea that things do not fit neatly together. Politics is likely to be a competition between legitimate opposing interests. Philosophy is likely to be a tension between competing half-truths. A personality is likely to be a battleground of valuable but incompatible traits. As Harry Clore put it in his brilliant book, On Moderation, "The fundamental division in the soul or psyche is at the root of our need for moderation." Eisenhower, for example, was fueled by passion and policed by self-control. Neither impulse was entirely useless and neither was entirely benign. Eisenhower's righteous rage could occasionally propel him toward justice, but it could occasionally blind him. His self-control enabled him to serve and do his duty, but it could make him callous. The moderate person contains opposing capacities to the nth degree. A moderate person can start out hot on both ends, both fervent in a capacity for rage and fervent in a desire for order, both Apollonian at work and Dionysian at play, both strong in faith and deeply doubtful, both Adam 1 and Adam 2. A moderate person can start out with these divisions and rival tendencies, but to live a coherent life, the moderate must find a series of balances and proportions. The moderate is forever seeking a series of temporary arrangements, embedded in the specific situation of the moment, that will help him or her balance the desire for security with the desire for risk, the call of liberty with the need for restraint. The moderate knows there is no ultimate resolution to these tensions. Great matters cannot be settled by taking into account just one principle or one viewpoint. Governing is more like sailing in a storm. Shift your weight one way when the boat tilts to starboard, shift your weight the other way when it tilts to port. Adjust and adjust and adjust to circumstances to keep the semblance and equanimity of an even keel. Eisenhower understood this intuitively. Writing to Swede, his boyhood friend, in his second term as president, he mused, "Possibly I am something like a ship which, buffeted and pounded by wind and wave, is still afloat, and manages, in spite of frequent tacks and turnings, to stay generally along its plotted course, and continues to make some, even if slow and painful, headway." As Clore observes, the moderate knows she cannot have it all. There are tensions between rival goods, and you just have to accept that you will never get to live a pure and perfect life, devoted to one truth or one value. The moderate has limited aspirations about what can be achieved in public life. The paradoxes embedded into any situation do not allow for a clean and ultimate resolution. You expand liberty at the cost of encouraging license. You crack down on license at the cost of limiting liberty. There is no escaping this sort of trade-off. The moderate can only hope to have a regulated character, stepping back to understand opposing perspectives and appreciating the merits of each. The moderate understands that political cultures are traditions of conflict. There are never-ending tensions that pit equality against achievement, centralization against decentralization, order and community against liberty and individualism. The moderate doesn't try to solve those arguments. There are no ultimate solutions. The moderate can only hope to achieve a balance that is consistent with the needs of the moment. The moderate does not believe there are some policy solutions that are right for all times. This seems obvious, but the rule is regularly flouted by ideologues in nation after nation. The moderate does not admire abstract schemes, but understands that it is necessary to legislate along the grain of human nature, and within the medium in which she happens to be placed. The moderate can only hope to be disciplined enough to combine in one soul, as Max Weber put it, both warm passion and a cool sense of proportion. He aims to be passionate about his ends, but deliberate about the proper means to realize them. The best moderate is blessed with a spirited soul, and also the proper character to tame it. The best moderate is skeptical of zealotry because he is skeptical of himself. He distrusts passionate intensity and bold simplicity because he knows that in politics, the lows are lower than the highs are high. The damage leaders do when they get things wrong is greater than the benefits they create when they get things right. Therefore, caution is the proper attitude, an awareness of the limits, the foundation of wisdom. For many people at the time, and for many years after, Eisenhower seemed like an emotionally flat simpleton with a passion for Western novels. His star has risen among historians as his inner turmoil has become better appreciated. And at the end of his presidency, he delivered a speech that still stands today as a perfect example of moderation in practice. Ike's speech came at a crucial pivot point in American politics and even public morality. On January 20, 1961, John F. Kennedy gave an inaugural address that signaled a cultural shift. Kennedy's speech was meant to indicate a new direction in the march of history. One generation and one era was ending, and another generation would, as he put it, begin anew. There would be a new endeavor and a new world of law. The possibilities, he argued, were limitless. Man holds in his mortal hands the power to abolish all forms of human poverty, he declared. Kennedy issued a call to uninhibited action. We shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship. He called on his listeners not just to tolerate problems, but to end them. Together let us explore the stars, conquer the deserts, eradicate disease. It was the speech of a man supremely confident in himself. It inspired millions of people around the world and set the tone and standard for political rhetoric ever since. 3 days earlier, however, Eisenhower had given a speech that epitomized the worldview that was fading away. Whereas Kennedy emphasized limitless possibilities, Eisenhower warned against hubris. Whereas Kennedy celebrated courage, Eisenhower celebrated prudence. Whereas Kennedy exhorted the nation to venture boldly forth, Eisenhower called for balance. The word balance recurs throughout his text, a need to balance competing priorities, balance between the private economy and the public economy, balance between the cost and hoped-for advantages, balance between the clearly necessary and the comfortably desirable, balance between our essential requirements as a nation and the duties imposed by the nation upon the individual. Balance between the actions of the moment and the national welfare of the future. Good judgment seeks balance and progress. Lack of it eventually finds imbalance and frustration. Eisenhower warned the country against belief in quick fixes. Americans, he said, should never believe that Some spectacular and costly action could become the miraculous solution to all current difficulties. He warned against human frailty, particularly the temptation to be short-sighted and selfish. He asked his countrymen to avoid the impulse to live only for today, plundering for our own ease and convenience the precious resources of tomorrow. Echoing the thrifty ethos of his childhood, he reminded the nation that we cannot mortgage the material assets of our grandchildren without risking the loss also of their political and spiritual heritage. He warned most famously about the undue concentration of power and the way unchecked power could lead to national ruin. He warned first about the military-industrial complex, a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. He also warned against a scientific technological elite, a powerful network of government-funded experts who might be tempted to take power away from the citizenry. Like the nation's founders, he built his politics on distrust of what people might do if they have unchecked power. He communicated the sense that in most times, leaders have more to gain from being stewards of what they have inherited than by being destroyers of what is there and creators of something new. This was the speech of a man who had been raised to check his impulses, and had then been chastened by life. It was the speech of a man who had seen what human beings are capable of, who had felt in his bones that man is a problem to himself. It was the speech of a man who used to tell his advisers, "Let's make our mistakes slowly," because it was better to proceed to a decision gradually than to rush into anything before its time. This is the lesson that his mother and his upbringing had imparted to him decades before. This was a life organized, not around self-expression, but self-restraint. Chapter 4. Struggle. On the night of April 18, 1906, when she was 8 years old, Dorothy Day was living in Oakland, California. She had, as usual, said her prayers at bedtime. She was the only religiously observant member of her household, and had become, as she wrote later, disgustingly, proudly pious. She had always had a sense, she wrote in her diary decades later, of an imminent spiritual world. The earth began shaking. When the rumbling began, her father rushed into the children's bedroom, snatched her two brothers, and rushed for the front door. Her mother grabbed her baby sister from Dorothy's arms. Her parents apparently figured Dorothy could take care of herself. She was left alone in her brass bed as it rolled back and forth across the polished floor. The night of the San Francisco earthquake, she felt that God was visiting her. "The earth became a sea which rocked our house in a most tumultuous manner," she recalled. She could hear the water in the rooftop tank splashing above her head. "These sensations were linked up with my idea of God as a tremendous force, a frightening, impersonal God, a hand stretched out to seize me, his child, and not in love." When the earth settled, the house was a mess. There were broken dishes all over the floor, along with books, chandeliers, and pieces of the ceiling and chimney. The city was in ruins, too, temporarily reduced to poverty and need. But in the days after, Bay Area residents pulled together. "While the crisis lasted, people loved each other," she wrote in her memoir decades later. "It was as though they were united in Christian solidarity. It makes one think of how people could, if they would, care for each other in times of stress, unjudgingly in pity and love." As the writer Paul Eli has put it, "A whole life is prefigured in that episode. The crisis, the sense of God's nearness, the awareness of poverty, the feeling of loneliness and abandonment, but also the sense that that loneliness can be filled by love and community, especially through solidarity with those in deepest need." Day was born with a passionate, ideal nature. Like Dorothea, the main character in George Eliot's novel Middlemarch, her nature demanded that she live an ideal life. She was unable to be satisfied with mere happiness, being in a good mood, enjoying the normal pleasures that friendships and accomplishments bring. As Eliot put it, her flame quickly burned up that light fuel, and fed from within, soared after some illimitable satisfaction, some object which would never justify weariness, which would reconcile self-despair with the rapturous consciousness of life beyond self. Day needed spiritual heroism, some transcendent purpose for which she could sacrifice. Children's Crusade. Dorothy's father had been a journalist, but the newspaper printing plant burned down in the quake and his job was gone. The family possessions lay in ruins. Day experienced the family's humiliating descent into poverty. Her father moved them to Chicago, where he set out to write a novel that was never published. A distant, distrustful man, he forbade his children to leave the house without permission or to invite friends in. Day remembered Sunday dinners, marked by gloomy silence, but for the sound of everybody chewing. Her mother did her best, but she suffered 4 miscarriages, and one night she fell into hysterics, smashing every dish in the home. The next day she was back to normal. "I lost my nerve," she explained to her children. In Chicago, Day noticed that her own family was much less affectionate than the families around her. "We were never handholders. We were always withdrawn and alone. Unlike Italians, Poles, Jews, and other friends who I had, who were fresh and spontaneous in their affections." She went to church and sang hymns with neighboring families. In the evenings she got on her knees and inflicted her piety on her sister. "I used to plague my sister with my long prayers. I would kneel until my knees ached and I was cold and stiff. She would beg me to come to bed and tell her a story." One day she had a conversation with her best friend, Mary Harrington, about a certain saint. Later in life, writing her memoirs, Day couldn't remember exactly which saint they were talking about, but she remembered, "My feeling of lofty enthusiasm, and how my heart almost burst with desire to take part in such high endeavor." One verse of the Psalms often comes to mind, "Enlarge thou my heart, O Lord, that thou mayest enter in." I was filled with a natural striving, a thrilling recognition of the possibilities of spiritual adventure. Parents in those days did not feel it necessary to entertain their children. Day remembered spending happy hours on the beach with her friends, fishing in creeks for eels, running away to an abandoned shack at the edge of a swamp, setting up a fantasy world and pretending that they would live there alone forever. Day also remembered long days of intolerable boredom, especially over the summer break. She tried to ease the tedium by doing household chores and reading. She read Charles Dickens, Edgar Allan Poe, and The Imitation of Christ by Thomas A. Kempis, among other books. With adolescence came a fascination with sex. She knew right away that she was thrilled by it. But she also had been taught that it was dangerous and evil. One afternoon when she was 15, Day was out in a park with her baby brother. The weather was perfect. The world was full of life, and there must have been boys around. In a letter she wrote at the time to her best friend, she describes, "a wicked, thrilling feeling at my heart." In the next passage, she remonstrates herself priggishly. "It is wrong to think so much about human love. All those feelings and cravings that come to us are sexual desires. We are prone to have them at this age, I suppose, but I think they are impure. It is sensual, and God is spiritual." In her superb memoir, The Long Loneliness, she reprints long passages from this letter. Her 15-year-old self continued, "How weak I am! My pride forbids me to write this, and to put it down on paper makes me blush. But all the old love comes back to me. It is a lust of the flesh, and I know that unless I forsake all sin, I will not gain the kingdom of heaven." The letter has all the self-involvement and paint-by-numbers self-righteousness that you'd expect in a precocious teenager. She's got the basic concept of her religion down, but not the humanity and the grace. But there's also an arduous spiritual ambition at work. Maybe if I stayed away from books more, this restlessness would pass. I am reading Dostoevsky. She resolves to fight her desires. Only after a hard, bitter struggle with sin, and only after we have overcome it, do we experience blessed joy and peace. I have so much work to do to overcome my sins. I am working always, always on guard, praying without ceasing to overcome all physical sensations to be purely spiritual. Reflecting on that letter in The Long Loneliness, which was published when she was in her 50s, Day confessed that it was filled with pomp and vanity and piety. I was writing of what interested me most, the conflict of flesh and spirit. But I was writing self-consciously and trying to pretend to myself I was being literary. But that letter displays some of the features that would eventually make Day one of the most inspiring religious figures and social workers of the 20th century. Her hunger to be pure, her capacity for intense self-criticism, her desire to dedicate herself to something lofty, her tendency to focus on hardship and not fully enjoy the simple pleasures available to her, her conviction that, fail as she might, and struggle as she would, God would ultimately redeem her from her failings. Bohemia. Day was one of three students in her high school to win a college scholarship, thanks to her excellence in Latin and Greek. She went to the University of Illinois, where she cleaned and ironed to pay for room and board, and was an indifferent student. She threw herself willy-nilly into activities that she hoped would lead to an epic life. She joined the Writers' Club, accepted for an essay in which she described what it was like to go without food for 3 days. She also joined the Socialist Party, broke from religion, and began doing what she could to offend the churchgoers. She decided the sweetness of girlhood was gone. It was time to be at war with society. At age 18, after a couple of years at Illinois, she decided that college life was unsatisfying. She moved to New York to become a writer. She wandered the city for months, desperately lonely. In all that great city of 7 millions, I found no friends. I had no work. I was separated from my fellows. Silence in the midst of city noises oppressed me. My own silence, the feeling that I had no one to talk to, overwhelmed me so that my very throat was constricted. My heart was heavy with unuttered thoughts. I wanted to weep my loneliness away. During this lonely period, she became indignant at the poverty she saw in New York, its different smell from the poverty she had seen in Chicago. "Everyone must go through something analogous to a conversion," she would later write. "Conversion to an idea, a thought, a desire, a dream, a vision. Without vision, the people perish." In my teens, I read Upton Sinclair's The Jungle and Jack London's The Road, and became converted to the poor, to a love for and desire to be always with the poor and suffering, the workers of the world. I was converted to the idea of the messianic mission of the proletariat. Russia was very much on people's minds then. Russian writers defined the spiritual imagination. The Russian Revolution inflamed young radicals' visions for the future. Dorothy's closest college friend, Raina Simons, moved to Moscow to be part of that future and died of illness after a few months there. In 1917, Day attended a rally celebrating the Russian Revolution. She felt a sense of exultation. The victory of the masses was at hand. Dorothy finally found work at a radical paper, The Call, for $5 a week. There she covered labor unrest and the lives of factory workers. She interviewed Leon Trotsky one day and a millionaire's butler the next. Newspaper life was intense. She was carried along by events, not reflecting on them, just letting them sweep over her. Although more an activist than an aesthete, she fell in with a bohemian crowd, with the critic Malcolm Cowley, the poet Alan Tate, and the novelist John Dos Passos. She formed a deep friendship with the radical writer Michael Gold. They would walk along the East River for hours, happily talking about their reading and their dreams. Occasionally, Gold would break into joyful song in Hebrew or Yiddish. She had a close, though apparently platonic, relationship with the playwright Eugene O'Neill, who shared her obsessions with loneliness, religion, and death. Day's biographer, Jim Forrest, writes that Dorothy would sometimes put O'Neill to bed, drunk and shaking with the terrors, and hold him until he fell asleep. He asked her to have sex with him, but she refused. She protested on behalf of the working classes. But the most vital dramas of her life were going on inside. She had become an even more avid reader, especially of Tolstoy and Dostoevsky. It's hard now to recapture how seriously people took novel reading then, or at least how seriously Day and others took it, reading important works as wisdom literature, believing that supreme artists possessed insights that could be handed down as revelation, trying to mold one's life around the heroic and deep souls one found in books. Day read as if her whole life depended upon it. Fewer people today see artists as oracles and novels as a form of revelation. The cognitive sciences have replaced literature as the way many people attempt to understand their own minds. But Day was moved to the depths of my being by Dostoevsky. The scene in Crime and Punishment, where the young prostitute reads from the New Testament to Raskolnikov, sensing sin more profound than her own. That story, The Honest Thief. Those passages in The Brothers Karamazov. Mitya's conversion in jail. The very legend of the Grand Inquisitor. All this helped to lead me on. She was especially drawn to the scene in which Father Zossima spoke glowingly of that love for God which resulted in a love for one's brother. The story of his conversion to love is moving, and that book, with its picture of religion, had a lot to do with my later life. She didn't just read Russian novels. She seemed to live them out. She was a heavy drinker and barfly. Malcolm Cowley wrote that gangsters loved her because she could drink them under the table, though that is hard to believe, given her rail-thin frame. The tragedies of her raucous life were there, too. A friend named Lewis Holiday took an overdose of heroin and died in her arms. In her memoir, she describes her moves from one rancid and airless apartment to another, but even she, self-critical as she was, leaves out some of the messiness. She leaves out her promiscuity, calling it a time of searching, and referring vaguely to the sadness of sin, the unspeakable dreariness of sin. In the spring of 1918, she volunteered as a nurse at Kings County Hospital as a deadly flu epidemic swept through the city and the world. More than 50 million people died of it between March 1918 and June 1920. She began work at 6 each morning and worked 12-hour days, changing linens, emptying bedpans, administering shots, enemas, and douches. The hospital was run like a military unit. When the head nurse entered the ward, the junior nurses stood at attention. I liked the order of life and the discipline. By contrast, the life that I had been leading seemed disorderly and futile, she recalled. One of the things that this year in the hospital made me realize is that one of the hardest things in the world is to organize ourselves and discipline ourselves. She met a newspaperman named Lionel Moyes at the hospital. They had a tumultuous physical relationship. "You are hard," she wrote to him lustfully. "I fell in love with you because you are hard." She got pregnant. He told her to get an abortion, which she did, also neglecting to mention it in her memoirs. One night, after he dumped her, she unhooked the gas pipe from the heater in her apartment and attempted suicide. A neighbor found her in time. In her memoirs, she writes that she left the hospital job because it eventually made her numb to suffering, and it left her no time to write. She neglected to mention that she had also agreed to marry a man twice her age named Berkeley Toby, a rich man from the Northwest. They traveled to Europe together, and after the trip was over, she left him. In her memoirs, she describes it as a solo trip, embarrassed that she had used Toby for a chance to go to Europe. "I didn't want to write what I was ashamed of," she would later tell the journalist Dwight MacDonald. "I felt I had used him and was ashamed." She also, crucially, was arrested twice, first in 1917 at age 20, and then in 1922 at age 25. The first time, it was in the name of political activism. She had become active in advocating for the rights of women. She was arrested for taking part in a suffragist protest in front of the White House and sentenced, with the rest of the protesters, to 30 days in jail. The prisoners began a hunger strike, but they, sitting there gnawed by hunger, soon slipped into a deep depression. She flipped from feeling solidarity with the hunger strikers to feeling that it was all somehow wrong and meaningless. "I lost all consciousness of any cause. I had no sense of being a radical. I could only feel darkness and desolation all around me. I had an ugly sense of the futility of human effort, man's helpless misery, the triumph of might. Evil triumphed. I was a petty creature, filled with self-deception, self-importance, unreal, false, and rightly scorned and punished." In jail, she asked for a Bible and read it intensely. Other prisoners told her stories of the solitary confinement cells where prisoners would be locked up for 6 months at a time. "Never would I recover from this wound. This ugly knowledge I had gained of what men were capable of in their treatment of each other." Day was taking a stand against injustice, but she was doing it without an organizing transcendent framework. She seems to have felt, unconsciously, and even then, that for her, activism without faith would fail. Her second imprisonment was even more emotionally devastating. She had gone to stay with a friend, a drug addict, in her apartment on Skid Row, in a building that served as both a whorehouse and a residence for members of the IWW, the Radical Union. The police raided the place, looking for subversives. The cops assumed that Day and her friend were prostitutes. They were forced to stand out on the street, semi-clad, before they were hauled off to jail. She was a victim of the red hysteria of the time, but she also felt she was a victim of her own imprudence and lack of integrity. She took the arrest as an indictment of her scattered life. "I do not think that ever again, no matter of what I am accused, can I suffer more than I did then of shame and regret and self-contempt. Not only because I had been caught, found out, branded, publicly humiliated, but because of my own consciousness that I deserved it." These are episodes of extraordinary self-scrutiny and self-criticism. Looking back years later, Day took a dim view of her own rowdy life. She saw it as a form of pride, as an attempt to define what was good and bad for herself, without reference to anything larger. "The life of the flesh called to me as a good and wholesome life, regardless of man's laws, which I felt rebelliously were made for the repression of others. The strong could make their own law, live their own lives. In fact, they were beyond good and evil. What was good, and what was evil? It is easy enough to stifle conscience for a time. The satisfied flesh has its own law." But Day was not just lost in a world of shallow infatuations, tumultuous affairs, fleshly satisfaction, and selfishness. Her extreme self-criticism flowed from a deep spiritual hunger. She used the word loneliness to describe this hunger. For many of us, that word brings to mind solitude. And Day was indeed solitary, and she did suffer from it. But Day also used the word loneliness to describe spiritual isolation. She had a sense that there was some transcendent cause or entity or activity out there, and that she would be restless until she found it. She was incapable of living life on the surface only, for pleasures, success, even for service, but needed a deep and total commitment to something holy. Childbirth. Day had spent her 20s throwing herself down different avenues, looking for a vocation. She tried politics. She took part in protests and marches, but they didn't satisfy. Unlike Frances Perkins, she was unfit for the life of politics with its compromises, self-seeking, shades of gray, and dirty hands. She needed a venue that would involve internal surrender, renunciation of self, commitment to something pure. She looked back on her early activism with disquiet and self-criticism. I do not know how sincere I was in my love of the poor and my desire to serve them. I wanted to go on picket lines, to go to jail, to write, to influence others, and so make my mark on the world. How much ambition and how much self-seeking there was in all of this. Then Day went the literary route. She wrote a novel about her disordered early life called The 11th Virgin, which was accepted by a New York publisher and optioned for $5,000 by a Hollywood studio. But this sort of literature did not cure the longing either, and the book would eventually make her feel ashamed. She later thought of buying up every existing copy. She thought that romantic love might satisfy her longing. She fell in love with a man named Forster Batterham, and they lived together, unmarried, in a house on Staten Island that Day bought with the proceeds of her novel. She describes Forster romantically in The Long Loneliness as an anarchist, an Englishman by descent, and a biologist. In fact, the truth is more prosaic. He made gauges in a factory. He had grown up in North Carolina and gone to Georgia Tech. He had an interest in radical politics. But Day's love for him was real. She loved him for his convictions, for his stubborn attachment to them, for his love of nature. She would, after their disagreements about fundamental things had become clear, still beg him to marry her. Day was still a passionate sexual woman, and her lust for him was real, too. "My desire for you is a painful rather than pleasurable emotion," she wrote in a letter that was released after her death. "It is a ravishing hunger which makes me want you more than anything in the world, and makes me feel as though I could barely exist until I saw you again." On September 21, 1925, during one of their separations, she wrote to him, "I made myself a beautiful new nightie, all lacy and exotic. Also several new pairs of panties, which you will be interested in, I am sure. I think of you much and dream of you every night, and if my dreams could affect you over long distance, I am sure they would keep you awake." When you read of Day and Batterham living their secluded life in Staten Island, reading, talking, making love, you get the impression that they, like many young couples newly in love, were trying to build what Sheldon Van Alken would call a shining barrier, a walled garden cut off from the world in which their love would be pure. Ultimately, Day's longing could not be contained within the shining barrier. Living with Batterham, taking long walks with him on the beach, she still felt a desire for something more. Among other things, she wanted a child. She felt her house was empty without one. In 1925, at age 28, she was thrilled when she learned she was pregnant. Batterham did not share her feelings. A self-styled radical, a modern man, he did not believe in bringing more human beings into the world. He certainly did not believe in the bourgeois institution of marriage, and he would never consent to marry her. While she was pregnant, it occurred to Day that most of the descriptions of childbirth had been written by men. She set out to rectify this. Shortly after giving birth, she wrote an essay on the experience, which eventually appeared in the New Masses. Day vividly described the physical struggle of the birth itself. "Earthquake and fire swept my body. My spirit was a battleground on which thousands were butchered in a most horrible manner. Through the rush and roar of the cataclysm, which was all about me, I heard the murmur of the doctor, and answered the murmur of the nurse in my head. In a white blaze of thankfulness, I knew that ether was forthcoming." When her daughter Tamar arrived, she was overwhelmed by gratitude. "If I had written the greatest book, composed the greatest symphony, painted the most beautiful painting or carved the most exquisite figure, I could not have felt the more exalted creator than I did when they placed my child in my arms. She felt the need for someone to thank. No human creature could receive or contain so vast a flood of love and joy as I often felt after the birth of my child. With this came the need to worship, to adore. But whom to thank? Whom to worship? A sense of God's reality and imminence came upon her, particularly on her long walks, when she found herself praying. She had trouble praying on her knees, but while she was walking, words of gratitude, praise, and obedience seemed to leap from her. A walk that began in misery could end in exaltation. Day was not answering the question of whether God exists. She was simply made aware of a presence beyond herself. She was surrendering to the belief that independent of one's own will, there is something significant that gives shape to life. If the life of a radical was a life of assertion and agency, a desire to steer history, she was turning to a life of obedience. God was in charge. As she later put it, she came to see that worship, adoration, thanksgiving, supplication, these were the noblest acts of which men were capable of in this life. The birth of her child began her transformation from a scattered person to a centered one, from an unhappy bohemian to a woman who had found her calling. Day had no obvious outlet for her faith. She was a member of no church. She was not comfortable with theology or traditional religious doctrines, but she felt hunted by God. "How can there be no God," she asked Forster, "when there are all these beautiful things?" Her attention turned to the Catholic Church. It was not church history that drew her, or papal authority, or even the political and social positions taken by the church. She knew nothing about Catholic theology and only knew the church itself as a backward and politically reactionary force. It was the people, not theology. It was the Catholic immigrants she had covered and served. Their poverty, their dignity, their communal spirit, and their generosity toward those who were down and out. Day's friends told her that she didn't need a religious institution to worship God, certainly not one as retrograde as the Catholic Church. But Day's experience as a radical taught her to associate herself as closely as possible with those who were suffering, to join in their walk, which meant joining their church. She observed that Catholicism already organized the lives of many poor urban families. It had won their allegiance. They poured into its churches on Sundays and holy days and in moments of joy and mourning. In the same way, the Catholic faith would provide structure for her life, and she hoped it would provide structure for her daughter. We all crave order, and in the book of Job, hell is described as a place where no order is. I felt that belonging to a church would bring order into Tamar's life, which I felt was lacking in my own. Day's adult faith was warmer and more joyful than the faith she'd experienced as a teenager. Day was particularly attracted to Saint Teresa of Avila, the 16th-century Spanish mystic and nun, whose experiences closely paralleled Day's own. The deeply spiritual childhood, the terror in the face of her own sinfulness, the occasional moments of what could be described as sexual ecstasy in his presence, the intense ambition to reform human institutions and serve the poor. Teresa lived a life of renunciation. She slept under a single woolen blanket. There was no heat in her convent except for a stove in one room. Her days were filled with prayer and penance, but she also possessed a lightness of spirit. Day said she loved the fact that Saint Teresa wore a bright red dress the day she entered the convent. She loved the fact that one day Teresa shocked her fellow nuns by taking out castanets and dancing. When she was the Mother Superior and the nuns under her became melancholy, she had the kitchen serve them steak. Teresa said that life is like a night spent in an uncomfortable inn, so you might as well do what you can to make it more pleasant. Day was becoming a Catholic, but she wasn't close to any practicing Catholics. But she encountered a nun walking down a street and asked her for instruction. The nun was shocked by Day's ignorance of Catholic teaching and berated her for it.